Case number 205722, United States of America v. Michael Clark. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Napolitano, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. I have requested 4 minutes reserved for rebuttal. Thank you. Your Honors, we've briefed a number of issues for you. I'd like to speak with you this morning about the first of those issues, which is a two-part argument concerning sufficiency of evidence, but really it strikes to issues broader than that, in that one of the elements that we believe the evidence was lacking to prove is, in part, the most critical of the elements, because it brings into question why are we here and ought we be here and not in a different jurisdictional forum. The question of jurisdiction in cases like this is often not a question. And the law has developed, I think, over the past 30 or so years, trying to keep step with the technology as it has developed over the past 30 years. And how we colloquially understood the internet as a broad concept, perhaps early on, ought to change as we know more about it. And I tend to think that the law is often written on factual fringes, and this presents just such a case. What we have here, Your Honors, is a distribution case in which there is no dispute as to where every bit of data originated and every bit of data ended and how it got there. And we know that through government witnesses. We know that through government witnesses who were state witnesses. There wasn't a single federal witness called in the case. And while that isn't dispositive by any means, I do think it's illustrative. This began as a state criminal prosecution. A state criminal investigation. It grew from that state investigation. There were two Kentucky officers at play. The expert who was called to testify about issues in the case was indeed a Kentucky Attorney General's employee who spoke at length about his forensic examination, but spoke not at all about the facts.
Your point is there's no interstate activity here, that this was all in Kentucky, and so federal law shouldn't apply? Is that basically what you're getting at?
It is, and there's no evidence to support the further question of whether there was an instrumentality of interstate commerce use.
But counsel, why isn't the internet itself an instrumentality of interstate commerce? So if I got on the interstate in Cincinnati, I could drive to Kentucky,
yes,
and then I would have crossed borders. I would have engaged in interstate commerce. But I could also drive somewhere else. I could drive to Cleveland on the interstate highway. Would I not have used a channel or instrumentality of interstate commerce?
Well, I think in that particular case, the question is rightly asked whether the instrumentality, as it is commonly understood, satisfies the jurisdictional hook necessary. You have, in the example that you cited, purely intrastate activity.
Right.
And the question of whether an interstate highway, for example, used for purely intrastate purposes, seems to be an open question. I cite in my reply brief a case that's not a criminal case, but it's a case in which a federal statute is seeking to be imposed regarding some labor standards in which something akin to what Your Honor posited was at issue. And the court in that case determined that just simply using an interstate for intrastate activity does not invoke federal jurisdiction. There is no question that the internet has been recognized by courts as being an instrumentality of interstate commerce. However, I think when the facts of a particular case, like this, cut the other way, unquestionably, and without any seeming argument, we have to look at that. We have to ask whether the purpose for which...
How are you distinguishing the other cases that would cut against your point?
Because what we know here, tells us that that intrastate activity is all that occurred. What we know here from all the facts that are in the record, and that's why this is, in essence, a sufficiency claim. What pile of facts was put before the jury upon which they could conclude?
What about the fact that, would you concede that the computer that was purchased to download and share, allegedly share, child pornography was an instrument of interstate commerce?
It could have been. And that's, again, where I think this case it gets tripped up, is, you know, we've all read cases in which the expert comes in and testifies. Usually it's a question or two about the manufacturer of that computer, and it's either manufactured internationally or it's manufactured.
This computer was manufactured in Kentucky.
There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever about its manufacture, and the burden remains with the government. It's not something we ought to assume, particularly when we're talking about jurisdiction.
How about the chip? So are there any chip manufacturers in Kentucky? So presumably it needs a processing system, it needs a chip, all these things. Is there any chip manufacturer or in Kentucky?
Your Honor, I don't know, but the record is also silent. And again, the burden of proof is on the government. This is an element that ought not be overlooked. This is perhaps the most critical element. It is the why are we here element. It is the why is this case being taken from the common law element. And to the extent that they wish to ask that question of an expert who could say, no, there is no such manufacturer in Kentucky, would that have satisfied the statute? Absolutely. And that's in fact what happens in the lion's share of cases. Indeed, I think the problem here is brought about by the fact that the Kentucky expert isn't used to answering those questions, probably didn't have that breadth of knowledge, because this jurisdiction element doesn't matter for a state prosecution. It's unique to federal prosecution.
What about like mail and wire fraud cases?
Yes.
Like what does our case law say there? Do we require, and isn't it sort of typically understood that use of, even if it's the defendant in one state and conduct in one state, that the wires or mail is used, that satisfies the interstate prong?
I'm aware of those cases. I would distinguish them on the fact that the substance of those crimes, the fraud element, is more inexorably intertwined with the commerce clause, right? The originating clause for which jurisdiction is invoked.
Right, but so, wait, I don't understand that. So if instead of sending child pornography across the internet,
yes,
if your client had put some child pornography in an envelope, some photographs, and mailed them from Lexington to Covington,
yes,
using the U.S. mail, so they never left Kentucky,
yes,
but they used the U.S. mail,
yes,
within the federal jurisdiction or not?
Yes, within the federal jurisdiction, I would think, because the U.S. mail is a uniquely federal institution.
If they use FedEx?
A closer question. And if they had driven it, from 75 or around 275, but within Kentucky, a different question. And I think a question that we ought not simply get past by saying, well, the internet was used. I don't know what the internet necessarily means. The cases talk about the sort of common understanding of it, this vast network of interconnected computers. But you know, when every time our devices hooks up to a Wi-Fi or we plug into an Ethernet port, are we accessing the internet? We really don't have those fine edges defined. And again, why this is critical is because this is jurisdictional, obviously. And I don't know that a reflexive approach to the application of this element is an appropriate approach, specifically in a case like this, where it is so well framed out in the facts how this information was transmitted. This is purely a distribution conviction. There was no receipt prosecution. So, you know, any question as to where these images emanated from, had they emanated from some source remote to Kentucky, isn't in the record and isn't before the court.
It just feels like prior cases that we haven't had this granular approach that you're advocating. We essentially said, I think Judge Larson said it, but as long as you look up the internet, that's typically enough. There's circumstantial evidence that would suggest that involves interstate commerce as an interstate connection. I don't think we've really
evidence before a jury precisely what occurred, and that there can be no question that none of what occurred occurred interstate. And
is it fair to say there's no circuit case that, from another circuit that effectively does what I would call this granular analysis that you want us to do, and Trump says this federal statute doesn't apply?
Judge Rayler, had I found it, I certainly would have cited it and made much of it. But I don't know that that necessarily closes the door on that analysis in this case. I see that I'm running out of time, so I appreciate your questions. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have your rebuttal time.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. Respectfully, the United States disagrees with the way that counsel has framed the first issue in the brief as an issue of the court's jurisdiction to hear the case. Rather, the focus on whether one of the elements of the crime that was charged in this case, the distribution of child pornography in violation of 18 U.S.C. 2252, that is a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence and whether the government presented proof beyond a reasonable doubt from which the jury could find that all the elements, including this one, was satisfied. And we did. Our presentation, the evidence that was presented, was consistent not only with, as Judge Rayler pointed out, the prior precedent of this court, but it was on par with the pattern jury instruction that this court has issued on this very crime. And that pattern jury instruction and the case law are both consistent, and they both reflect that the internet is an instrumentality of interstate commerce. The defendant counsel focuses on the fact that the investigator in this case, who conducted the downloads from the defendant's computer, that they both, the originating and the receiving computer, were in Kentucky. But again, that ignores the fact that in order for this distribution to have occurred, several things had to have been in place. First, both computers had to have been on the internet. Both computers had to have both been operating on the BitTorrent peer-to-peer file sharing network. Both computers had to be using some sort of compatible client software. And then finally, there had to have been a successful download, meaning that the child pornography was available for sharing and was in fact downloaded by the investigator in this case. And so the United States, we presented evidence that established all of those elements, that the child pornography was available for distribution, was successfully downloaded, and was only able to have been done so by the investigator in this case because his computer and the defendant's were both using the internet.
So your point is that available for distribution means that because someone in Indiana could have downloaded it, that's enough.
Available for distribution in the peer-to-peer context, like
yes,
this, means that it is available for sharing, which is the flip side to the coin, the peer-to-peer file sharing coin. This kind of software is used by people to download content. A lot of legal content is downloaded via peer-to-peer file sharing. It has also become the predominant way that illegal content is downloaded due to the decentralized nature of how content is able to be shared. But this software is used by individuals to download. But the flip side to that coin is that they can only download if they share. If they don't share, it essentially throttles their ability to download content.
But my question is maybe not exactly that. The point being made by your adversary here is that because it wasn't actually downloaded outside of the state of Kentucky, there isn't any actual evidence of interstate activity. And so my question is the mere availability through the sharing files, is that sufficient to show that indeed we have an internet in interstate commerce?
I don't think so. I think that goes more to the distribution element as opposed to the interstate nexus element, which I think is what counsel is referring to as a jurisdictional element, whereas the United States is referring to it more. for sharing and for download by other peers, which are the other computers on the peer-to-peer file sharing network, that's sufficient for the distribution element under 2252A2, not so much for the interstate commerce element.
So to follow up on that, is it your argument then that you don't, well, it wouldn't be your argument, but do you not have a case that says that the interstate commerce element is satisfied merely by making images available in Kentucky for distribution, presumably worldwide, or at least nationwide?
Well,
I mean, you have to meet all of the elements.
Absolutely.
So how do you meet the interstate commerce one, if not the way that Judge Batchelder just proposed?
Well, we meet it because, consistent with this court's prior precedent in United States versus Kena, which was this very issue was addressed and litigated in that case. And this court held that the use of the internet, or the internet is an instrument or facility of interstate commerce. In that case, as opposed to some of the cases that my opponent has relied on, is on all fours with this case. It was a case involving the distribution of child pornography. And the court, frankly, didn't spend all that much time on it because it is consistent with the pattern jury instruction that has been approved by this court for this particular crime.
Why wouldn't we? I mean, I understand it's a sort of default rule that so long as you connect to the internet, that satisfies the jurisdictional prong. But why wouldn't we actually want to look behind the scenes to see whether there is actually an interstate component to the case? And we do that in a lot of contexts. And why would we just want to assume that in every case it's easier, certainly, and it's easier for the government to establish? And your point that we didn't spend a lot of time on, I don't know how that cuts. But why wouldn't we actually want to put the government to its proof beyond just showing?
Well, I think we do. I just think, as counsel indicated, there's a number of different ways that the government does that. As counsel indicated, sometimes it's just by introducing the particular computer, the laptop, having an expert.
Well, you didn't do that here, I don't think.
We did not. No, so I
agree there's lots of ways you could do it. I think one of his points is you didn't do those things here.
We didn't do
and
one of
the laptop point you didn't make, I don't think.
There was no question posed to a witness about where the MacBook Pro was manufactured. The computer itself was admitted into evidence. But the government did focus on satisfying the interstate commerce element through the testimony of the investigator who conducted the downloads in this case, who explained technically the way that he was able to conduct the downloads and that he would not have been able to do that without the internet. I think that the pattern jury instruction in this court's prior rulings on this, I don't think it was born out of what's easiest for the government to be able to prove or to satisfy this element. I think it's just a clear recognition of the way the internet works. And the fact, secondarily, that in many cases in federal court, that interstate nexus element is many courts instruct juries, it only needs to be a de minimis connection. It doesn't even have to be a connection that the defendant has to know about. It just has to be, and in this case, these downloads could not have been conducted by the investigator in this case from the defendant's computer without the use of the internet.
But that assumes that the internet itself, the use of the internet itself, is a use of an instrumentality of interstate commerce.
It does, consistent with what this
So you're saying that if we were to go the other direction, we would be ruling against our precedent. Is that what you're saying?
You would. In the United States versus PINA and in...
Except that there wasn't ever... I know what PINA said, but there isn't anything really in that case that questions it, that there's not much evidence supporting that. That was just sort of a given there. Not to mention, as I read it, I think a little bit of a misapprehension about what a case that case relied on had actually said.
Well, I'm not sure that there was as clear a factual record about where the two computers were as there was in this case. Undisputed in this case, the investigator who was running his undercover computer was in Kentucky, in Campbell County, Kentucky. The defendant's computer was at his home in Kenton County, Kentucky. But as the detective testified,
illegal types of pornography.
Well, I think, to clarify, I think the defendant's defense at trial was multifaceted and somewhat shifting. I think it was the idea that...
Well, defendants do that sometimes. I mean,
absolutely, they do.
Convince a juror, so they...
Mr. Theroff was one of a couple of different witnesses who the defendant said could have been responsible for doing these downloads, but you're right. But that actually wasn't the proffered cross that the defense wanted to get into a trial. It wasn't that Theroff actually distributed child pornography. He wanted to get into Mr. Theroff's personal and intimate life, and that perhaps he and his girlfriend had publicized that in some form or fashion. I'm frankly not even sure what the evidence was other than that, but I think what the district court did after much back and forth, first of all, none of that goes to, there is a chasm between what is legal to be, what's done legally between consenting adults and what was done here, the content that we're talking about here. One's illegal, one's not. And probing a witness's personal life in that manner, when it has nothing to do with his reputation or truthfulness or untruthfulness, the district court correctly...
The theory was that he was somehow involved with the illegal distribution. That individual was somehow involved there. And you're right, there's a chasm, but there's also 17 versus 18. If it's an image of an 18-year-old, legal, 17, illegal. My point is, I thought they were arguing that he was involved in this general kind of behavior and could have done both legal and illegal, and it wasn't actually clear. I'm not saying it was convincing, but that seemed to be the point. I thought there was at least maybe some relevance or some reason why the judge might let that question come in.
Well, and I think the way that there was lots of argument about this, and in fact, the district court went back and forth a couple of times before settling on, rightfully so, the foundation and the rules set out in Rule 608. But I don't think it was ever clear what the age of Mr. Theroff and his girlfriend were.
I didn't mean their age. That's been, you're saying there's debate if it's legal conduct, but on the margins here, the age of the individual in the image makes a big difference.
It does.
And anyhow, your point is just that this was not the defendant's theory. The theory I just crafted was not what the defendant was arguing.
I'm sorry, no, I didn't mean to interrupt. I don't believe that was the proffered cross-examination that was excluded, properly so, by the district court. The record reflects that defense counsel wanted to cross Mr. Theroff on details of his personal and intimate, frankly, sex life with his girlfriend, and there was no indication.
I thought that.
But that sex life involved distribution of images of them engaging in sexual behavior, right? Which is different than, to be sure, what Mr. Clark is accused of, but not like complete. I mean, he's distributing pornography over the internet, so. Is it child pornography or not, it's still sort of the same ilk. I think that's the defendant's point.
And I think the record is unclear about the distribution angle. I think that all that counsel proffered to the district court was that Mr. Theroff and his girlfriend had engaged in sexual conduct and publicized it in some way. And that's all the record reflects. So whether that's distribution, I think, is a different question. But where the rubber meets the road in this case is the defense wanted to cross one of the government's witnesses about personal and intimate details of his sex life that were not illegal. And he had every opportunity and did, and in fact the government did ask if Mr. Theroff had any involvement in the conduct that occurred in the Clark household, which he vehemently denied. I see my time is up, unless the court has any additional questions. I'll conclude.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Napolitano.
Thank you, Your Honor. Picking it up where counsel ended, Mr. Clark's trial counsel advised the district court that he intended to cross-examine Mr. Theroff about his participation in the production and distribution pornographic videos involving adults via a peer-to-peer sharing program. That's at the trial transcript, the second volume, page ID 599. So the question ostensibly of Mr. Theroff and the girlfriend of girlfriends that they had produced and distributed. With regard to Judge Batchelder's question about available for sharing, it's a very good question. I don't know that it's necessarily answered in the law. It sort of strikes to this granularity that I'm urging for, particularly in a situation where we just don't have evidence to support that. But what I will say is what we do have evidence of is not that here. On the facts of this case, you have Detective Cush talking about his very specific single-source download platform, his very specific software, which he called Torrential Downpour, which is designed to sort of knock out that broad-based availability of which you speak, ostensibly for the purpose of proving it's this guy, Mr. Clark, who is doing the distribution. Because normally what happens is if you want, Raiders of the Lost Ark, you go out and it comes from a variety of different sources, pieces from here, pieces from there, and you have a host of individuals who are distributing that file. Here, for purposes of a criminal prosecution, it has to be that person. And so his software is designed to specifically knock out.
So are you saying that if there had been testimony about what you just described,
indeed,
the many sources that would come together to produce one image or one set of images, if there had been testimony relative to that, that would have satisfied your concern?
I think it certainly would have struck closer to what Your Honor was speaking about in terms of the availability potentially being the critical nexus to interstate commerce necessary to satisfy the jurisdictional hook. And while it is a sufficiency argument, that's how we get jurisdiction through these cases, is through that element. So, but there wasn't such testimony here. There was testimony about that being the way it often works, but not here, and specifically not here, and specifically not here by the design of Kentucky law enforcement. And for those reasons, we don't think this ought to have been